where he had been posted, whom he had served with or under, who he knew. It had happened twice already. They'd called upon the commanders of Fort Saint-Jean and Fort Chambly, and in both instances Randall Isaacs had presented their credentials, mentioning casually that William was the son of Lord John Grey, whereupon the official welcome had warmed at once into a long late evening of reminiscence and conversation, fueled by good brandy, during which, William now realized, he and the commanders had done all the talking, and Randall Isaacs had sat listening, his handsome high-coloured face aglow with a flattering interest. "Hm," William thought to himself. Having worked it out, he wasn't sure how he felt about it. On the one hand, he was pleased with himself for having smoked what was going on. On the other, he was less pleased to think that he was desirable mainly for his connections, rather than his own virtues. Well, it was useful, if humbling, to know. What he didn't know was exactly what Randall Isaac's role was. Was he only gathering information for Richardson, or had he other business unspoken? Often enough, Randall Isaacs had left him to his own devices, saying casually that he had a private errand for which he thought his own French adequate. They were, according to the very limited instruction Captain Richardson had given him, assessing the sentiments of the French habitants and the English settlers in Quebec, with an eye to future support in case of incursion by the American rebels or attempted threats and seductions by the Continental Congress. These sentiments so far seemed clear, if not what he might have expected. The French settlers in the area were in sympathy with Sir Guy, who, as Governor-General of North America, had passed the Quebec Act, which legalized Catholicism and protected the French Catholics' trade. The English were disgruntled by the same act, for obvious reasons, and had declined, en masse, to answer Sir Guy's calls for militia assistance during the American attack on the city during the previous winter. "They must have been insane," he remarked to Randall Isaacs as they crossed the open plain before the citadel. "The Americans who tried it on here last year, I mean." They'd reached the top of the cliff now, and the citadel rose from the plain before them, peaceful and solid, very solid, in the autumn sun. The day was warm and beautiful, and the air was alive with the rich earthy smells of the river and forest. He'd never seen such a forest. The trees that edged the plain and grew all along the banks of the St. Lawrence grew impenetrably thick, now blazing with gold and crimson. Seen against the darkness of the water and the impossible deep blue of the vast October sky, the whole of it gave him the dreamlike feeling of riding through a medieval painting, glowing with gold leaf, and burning with a sense of otherworldly fervour. But beyond the beauty of it, he felt the savagery of the place, felt it with a clarity that made his bones feel transparent. The days were still warm, but the chill of winter was a sharp tooth that bit harder with each day's twilight, and it took very little imagination for him to see this plain as it would be in a few weeks from now, cloaked in bitter ice, whitely inhospitable to all life. With a ride of 200 miles behind him, and an immediate understanding of the problems of supply for two riders on the rugged journey north in good weather, combined with what he knew of the rigours of supplying an army in bad weather. "If they weren't insane, they wouldn't be doing what they are doing." Randall Isaacs interrupted his thoughts, he too drawing up for a moment to look over the prospect with a soldier's eye. "It was Colonel Arnold who led them here, though. That man is certainly insane, but a damn good soldier." Admiration showed in his voice, and William glanced curiously at him. "Know him, do you?" he asked casually. And Randall Isaacs laughed. "Not to speak to," he replied. "Come on." He spurred up, and they turned toward the citadel gate. He wore an amused, half-contemptuous expression, though, as if dwelling on a memory, and after a few moments he spoke again. "They might have done it. Arnold, I mean. Taken the city. Sir Guy hadn't any troops to speak of, and had Arnold got here when he planned to, and with the powder and shot he needed,
Well, it would have been a different story. But he chose the wrong man to ask directions of.
What do you mean by that? Randall Isaacs looked suddenly wary, but then seemed to shrug internally, as though to say,
What does it matter?
He was in good humour, already looking forward to a hot dinner, a soft bed, and clean linen after weeks of camping in the dark forests.
He couldn't make it overland, he said. Seeking a way to carry an army and its necessities north by water, Arnold had gone looking for someone who had made the hazardous trip and knew the rivers and portages,
Randall Isaacs said.
He found one, too. Samuel Goodwin. But it never occurred to him that Goodwin might be a loyalist.
Randall Isaacs shook his head at this naivety.
Goodwin came to me and asked what he should do. So I told him, and he gave Arnold his maps, carefully rewritten, to serve their purpose.
And serve their purpose they had, by misstating distances, removing landmarks, indicating passages where there were none, and providing maps that were pure figments of imagination. Mr. Goodwin's guidance succeeded in luring Arnold's force deep into the wilderness, obliging them to carry their ships and supplies overland for days on end, and eventually delaying them so badly that the winter caught them well short of Quebec City. Randall Isaacs laughed, though there was a tinge of regret about it, William thought.
I was amazed when they told me he'd made it after all. Aside from everything else, he'd been swindled by the carpenters who made his ships. I do believe that it was sheer incompetence, not politics, though. These days it's sometimes hard to tell. Made with green timbers and badly fitted. More than half of them came apart and sank within days of launching.
It had to have been sheer hell, Randall Isaacs said, as though to himself. He pulled himself up straight then, shaking his head.
But they followed him. All his men. Only one company turned back. Starving, half-naked, freezing. They followed him, he repeated, marvelling.
He glanced sideways at William, smiling.
Think your men would follow you, Lieutenant, in such conditions? I hope I should have better sense than to lead them into such conditions, William replied dryly. What happened to Arnold in the end? Was he captured? No, Randall Isaacs said thoughtfully, lifting a hand to wave at the guards by the citadel gate. No, he wasn't. As to what's happened to him now, God only knows. Or God and Sir Guy. I'm hoping the latter can tell us.
Chapter 24.
Joyeux Noël.
London, December the 24th, 1776.
Most prosperous madams were stout creatures, Lord John reflected. Whether it was only the satisfaction of appetites denied in their early years, or was a shield against the possibility of a return to the lower stations of their trade, almost all of them were well armoured in flesh. Not Nessie.
He could see the shadow of her body through the thin muslin of her shift. He had inadvertently roused her from her bed, as she stood before the fire to pull on her bed sack. She bore not an ounce more upon her scrawny frame than she had when he'd first met her,
then aged, she'd said, 14, though he'd suspected at the time that she might be 11.
That would make her 30-odd. She still looked 14. He smiled at the notion, and she smiled back, tying her gown. The smile aged her a bit, for there were gaps among her teeth, and the remainder showed black at the root. If she was not stout, it was because she lacked the capacity to become so. She adored sugar, and would eat an entire box of candied violets or Turkish delight in minutes, compensating for the starvation of her youth in the Scottish Highlands. He'd brought her a pound of sugar plums.
"Think I'm that cheap, do you?"
she said, raising a brow as she took the prettily wrapped box from him.
"Never," he assured her. That is merely by way of apology for having disturbed your rest.
That was improvisation. He had, in fact, expected to find her at work, it being past 10 o'clock at night.
Well, it is Christmas Eve,
she said, answering his unasked question. "Any man we are whom to go to's in it." She yawned, pulled off her nightcap, and fluffed her fingers through the wild mass of curly dark hair.
"Yet you seem to have some custom," he observed.
Distant singing came from two floors below, and the parlour had seemed well populated when he passed.
"Och, aye, the desperate ones. I leave them to Maybelle to deal with. Dinna like to see them, poor creatures. Pitiful. They dinna really want a woman. The ones who come on Christmas Eve. Only a fire to sit by and folk to sit with."
She waved a hand and sat down, greedily pulling the bow from her present.
"Let me wish you a happy Christmas, then," he said, watching her with amused affection.
She popped one of the sweetmeats into her mouth, closed her eyes, and sighed in ecstasy.
"Mmm," she said, not pausing to swallow before inserting and masticating another.
From the cordial intonation of this remark, he assumed her to be returning the sentiment. He'd known it was Christmas Eve, of course, but had somehow put the knowledge of it out of his head during the long cold hours of the day. It had poured all day, driving needles of freezing rain, augmented now and then by irritable bursts of hail, and he'd been chilled through since just before dawn, when Minnie's footman had roused him with a summons to Argus House. Nessie's room was small but elegant, and smelled comfortably of sleep. Her bed was vast, hung with woolen bed curtains done in the very fashionable pink and black Queen Charlotte checks. Tired, cold, and hungry as he was, he felt the pull of that warm, inviting cavern with its mounds of goose-down pillows, quilts, and clean, soft sheets. What would she think, he wondered, if he asked to share her bed for the night?
A fire to sit by and folk to sit with. Well, he had that, at least for the moment.
Grey became aware of a low buzzing noise, something like a trapped bluebottle flinging itself against a window pane. Glancing toward the sound, he perceived that what he had thought to be merely a heap of rumpled bedclothes, in fact, contained a body. The elaborate, passementeri tassel of a nightcap trailed across the pillow.
"That's no but Rab," said an amused Scottish voice, and he turned to find her grinning at him. "Fancy it three ways, do you?"
He realised, even as he blushed, that he liked her not only for herself, or for her skill as an intelligence agent, but because she had an unexcelled ability to disconcert him. He thought she didn't know the shape of his own desires exactly, but she'd been a whore since childhood, and likely had a shrewd apprehension of almost anyone's desires, whether conscious or not.
"Oh, I think not," he said politely. "I shouldn't wish to disturb your husband."
He tried not to think of Rab McNab's brutal hands and solid thighs. Rab had been a chairman before his marriage to Nessie, and the success of the brothel they owned.
Surely he didn't also.
"You couldn't wait young Yuffie with cannon fire," she said with an affectionate glance into the bed.
She got up, though, and pulled the curtains across, muffling the snoring.
"Speak o' cannon," she added, bending to peer at Grey as she returned to her seat. "You look as though you've been in the wars yourself. Here, have a dram, and I'll ring for a bit of hot supper."
She nodded at the decanter and glasses that stood on the elbow table and reached for the bell rope.
"No, I thank you, I haven't much time. But I will take a drop to keep the cold out. Thank you."
The whisky? She drank nothing else, scorning gin as a beggar's drink, and regarding wine as good but insufficient to its purpose, warmed him, and his wet coat had begun to steam in the fire's heat.
"You've not much time," she said. "Why's that, then?"
"I'm bound for France," he said, "in the morning."
Her eyebrows shot up, and she put another comfit in her mouth.
"You don't mean to keep Christmas with your family?"
"Don't talk with your mouth full, my dear," he said, smiling nonetheless.
"My brother suffered a bad attack last night. His heart, the quack says, but I doubt he really knows. The usual Christmas dinner is likely to be somewhat less of an occasion than usual, though."
"I'm that sorry to hear," Nessie said more clearly.
She wiped sugar from the corner of her mouth, brow puckered with a troubled frown.
His lordship's a fine man.
Yes, he...
He stopped, staring at her.
You've met my brother?
Nessie dimpled demurely at him. Discretion is a madam's most valuable stock in trade, she chanted, clearly parroting the wisdom of a former employer.
Says the woman who's spying for me.
He was trying to envision how, or perhaps not to envision how, for surely he wouldn't. To spare Minnie his demands, perhaps. But he thought,
I will. Spying's no the same as idle gossip now, is it? I want tea, even if you don't. Talking's thirsty work.
She rang the bell for the porter, then turned back, one eyebrow raised.
Your brother's dying, and you're going to France? Must be somewhat urgent, then.
He's not dying, Gray said sharply.
The thought of it split the carpet at his feet, a grinning abyss waiting to pull him in. He looked determinedly away from it.
He had a shock. Word was brought that his youngest son was wounded in America and has been captured.
Her eyes widened at that, and she clutched the dressing gown closer to her non-existent breasts.
The youngest? That would be Henry, no?
It would. And how the devil do you know that? He demanded, agitation making his voice harsh.
A gap-toothed smile glimmered at him, but then went away as she saw the depth of his distress.
One of his lordship's footmen is a regular, she said simply. Thursdays, it's his night off.
Oh.
He sat still, hands on his knees, trying to bring his thoughts and his feelings under some kind of control.
I see.
It's late in the year to be getting messages from America, no?
She glanced at the window, which was covered in layers of red velvet and lace that were unable to keep out the sound of lashing rain.
Did a late ship come in?
Yes. Blown off course and limped into Brest with a wounded mainmast. The message was brought overland.
And is it Brest you're going to, then?
It is not.
A soft scratching came at the door before she could ask anything further, and she went to let in the porter, who had, without being asked, Gray noted, brought up a tray laden with tea things, including a thickly iced cake.
He turned it over in his mind. Could he tell her?
But she hadn't been joking about discretion, he knew. In her own way, she kept secrets as much and as well as he did.
It's about William, he said, as she shut the door and turned back to him.
He knew dawn was near from the ache in his bones and the faint chime of his pocket watch. There was no sign of it in the sky. Clouds the colour of chimney sweepings brushed the roofs of London, and the streets were blacker than they had been at midnight, all lanterns having been long since extinguished, all half-fires burnt low. He'd been up all night. There were things he must do. He ought to go home and sleep for a few hours before catching the Dover coach. He couldn't go without seeing Hal once more, though, just to assure himself. There were lights in the windows of Argus House. Even with the drapes drawn, a faint gleam showed on the wet cobbles outside. It was snowing thickly, but wasn't yet sticking to the ground. There was a good chance that the coach would be detained. Was sure to be slow, bogged down on the miry roads. Speaking of coaches, his heart gave a sickly leap at the sight of a battered-looking carriage standing in the porte cochere, which he thought belonged to the doctor. His thump at the door was answered at once by a half-dressed footman, nightshirt tucked hastily into his breeches. The man's anxious face relaxed a little when he recognised Gray.
The Duke? Took bad in the night, my lord, but easier now.
The man, Arthur, that was his name, interrupted him, stepping back to let him in and taking the cloak from his shoulders, shaking off the snow. He nodded and made for the stair, not waiting to be shown up. He met the doctor coming down, a thin grey man marked by his black, ill-smelling coat and the bag in his hand.
"How is he?" he demanded, seizing the man by the sleeve as he reached the landing. The doctor drew back, affronted, but then saw his face in the glow from the sconce, and, recognizing his resemblance to Hal, settled his ruffled feathers.
"Somewhat better, my lord. I have let him blood 3 ounces, and his breathing is grown easier."
Grey let go of the sleeve and bounded up the stairs, his own chest tight. The door to Hal's suite of rooms stood open, and he went in at once, startling a maid who was carrying out a chamber pot, lidded, and then delicately draped with a cloth handsomely embroidered with large, brilliant flowers. He brushed past her with a nod of apology, and went into Hal's bedroom. Hal was sitting up against the bolster, pillows wedged behind him. He looked nearly dead. Minnie was beside him, her pleasant round face gaunt with anxiety and sleeplessness.
"I see you even shit with style, Your Grace,"
Grey remarked, sitting down on the other side of the bed. Hal opened one grey lid and eyed him. The face might be that of a skeleton, but the pale, sharp eye was the living Hal, and Grey felt his chest flood with relief.
"Oh, the cloth,"
Hal said, weakly but clearly.
"That's Dotty. She will not go out, even though I assured her that if I thought I was going to die, I should certainly wait for her return to do it."
He paused to breathe with a faint wheezing note, then coughed and went on.
"She's not the sort, thank God, to indulge in pieties. She has no musical talent, and her vitality is such that she is a menace to the kitchen staff. So Minnie set her to needlework as some outlet for her formidable energies. She takes after Mother, you know."
"I am sorry, John," Minnie said apologetically to him. "I sent her to bed, but I saw that her candle is still lit. I believe she is at work this moment on a pair of carpet slippers for you."
Grey thought carpet slippers were likely innocuous, whatever motif she had chosen, and said so. "So long as she isn't embroidering a pair of drawers for me. The knot work, you know."
That made Hal laugh, which in turn made him cough alarmingly, though it brought a little colour back into his face.
"So you aren't dying?" Grey asked.
"No,"
Hal said shortly.
"Good,"
said Grey, smiling at his brother. "Don't."
Hal blinked, and then, recalling the occasion on which he had said exactly that to Grey, smiled back.
"Do my best,"
he said dryly, and then, turning, laid an affectionate hand on Minnie's.
"My dear."
"I'll have some tea brought up," she said, rising at once. "And a good hot breakfast," she added, after a scrutinizing look at Grey.
She closed the door delicately behind her.
"What is it?"
Hal hitched himself higher on the pillow, disregarding the blood-stained cloth wrapped round one forearm.
"You have news?"
"Very little, but a great number of alarming questions."
The news of Henry's capture had been enclosed as a note for Hal, inside a letter to himself, from one of his contacts in the intelligencing world, and carried an answer to his inquiries regarding the known French connections of one Percival Beauchamp. He hadn't wanted to discuss that with Hal until he'd seen Nessie, though, and Hal had been in no condition for such discussions anyway.
"No known connections between Beauchamp and Vergennes," naming the French foreign minister, "but he has been seen often in company with Beaumarchais."
That provoked another coughing fit.
"Little fucking wonder,"
Hal observed hoarsely upon his recovery.
"A mutual interest in hunting, no doubt."
That last was a sarcastic reference both to Percy's disinclination for blood sports and to Beaumarchais' title of Lieutenant General of Hunting, bestowed upon him some years previous by the late king.
"And," Grey went on, ignoring this, "with one Silas Deane."
Hal frowned.
"Who?"
"An American merchant, in Paris on behalf of the American Congress. He skulks round Beaumarchais, rather, and he's been seen speaking with Vergennes."
"Oh, him."
Hal flapped a hand.
"Heard of him. Vaguely.
Have you heard of a business called Rodrigo Tellez et Compagnie?
No. Sounds Spanish, doesn't it?
Or Portuguese. My informant had nothing but the name and a rumour that Beaumarchais has something to do with it.
Hal grunted and lay back.
Beaumarchais has his fingers in any number of pies. Makes watches, for God's sake, as though writing plays weren't bad enough. Has Beauchamp anything to do with this company?
Not known. It's all vague associations at this point, nothing more. I asked for everything that could be turned up that had anything, anything, not generally known, I mean, to do with Beauchamp or the Americans. This is what came back.
Hal's slender fingers played restless scales on the coverlet.
Does your informant know what this Spanish company does?
Trade? What else? Gray replied ironically, and Hal snorted.
If they were bankers as well, I'd think you might have something.
I might at that. But the only way to find out, I think, is to go and poke at things with a sharp stick. I'm taking the coach to Dover in...
He squinted at the carriage clock on the mantel, obscured by the gloom.
3 hours.
Ah.
The voice was non-committal, but Gray knew his brother very well indeed.
I'll be back from France by the end of March at the latest, he said, adding gently, I shall be on the first ship that sails for the colonies in the new year, Hal. And I'll bring Henry back.
Alive or dead. Neither of them spoke the words. They didn't need to.
I'll be here when you do,
Hal said at last, quietly. Gray put his hand over his brother's, which turned at once to take his. It might look frail, but he was heartened at the determined strength in Hal's grasp. They sat in silence, hands linked, until the door opened, and Arthur, now fully dressed, sidled in with a tray the size of a card table, laden with bacon, sausages, kidneys, kippers, sheared eggs in butter, grilled mushrooms and tomatoes, toast, jam, marmalade, a huge pot of fragrantly steaming tea, bowls of sugar and milk, and a covered dish which he set ceremoniously before Hal, this proving to be filled with a sort of nasty thin gruel. Arthur bowed and went out, leaving Gray wondering whether he was the footman who went to Nessie's house on Thursdays. He turned back to find Hal helping himself liberally to Gray's kidneys.
Aren't you meant to be eating your slop?
Gray inquired.
Don't tell me you're determined to hasten me into my grave too,
Hal said, closing his eyes in brief rapture as he chewed.
How the devil anyone expects me to recover, fed on things like rusks and gruel.
Huffing, he speared another kidney.
Is it really your heart, do you think?
Gray asked. Hal shook his head.
I really don't think so, he said, his tone detached. I listened to it, you know, after the first attack, wanging away just as usual.
He paused to prod himself experimentally in the chest, fork suspended in the air.
It doesn't hurt there. Surely it would, wouldn't it?
Gray shrugged.
What sort of attack was it, then?
Hal swallowed the last of the kidney and reached for a slice of buttered toast, taking up the marmalade knife in his other hand.
Couldn't breathe, he said casually. Turned blue, that sort of thing.
Oh, well then.
I feel quite well just now, Hal said, sounding mildly surprised.
Do you? Gray said, smiling.
He had a moment's reservation, but after all, he was going abroad, and unexpected things not only could happen, but often did. Best not leave the matter hanging, just in case something untoward befell either one of them before they met again.
Well then, if you're sure that a minor shock will not shuffle off your mortal coil, allow me to tell you something.
His news regarding the tendresse existing between Dotty and William made Hal blink and stop eating momentarily. But after a moment's contemplation, he nodded and resumed chewing.
All right, he said.
All right, Gray echoed.
You have no objections? hardly sit well with you if I did, would it?
If you expect me to believe that a concern for my feelings would in any way affect your own actions, your illness has severely damaged you.
Hal grinned briefly and drank tea.
No,
he said, setting down the empty cup.
Not that. It's just...
He leaned back, hands clasped over his very slightly protruding belly, and gave Gray a straight look.
I could die. Don't mean to. Don't think I will. But I could. I'd die easier if I knew she was settled with someone who'd protect her and look after her properly.
I'm flattered that you think William would, Gray said dryly,
though he was in fact immensely pleased.
Of course he would, Hal said, matter of fact. He's your son, isn't he?
A church bell began to ring somewhere in the distance, reminding Gray.
Oh, he said, happy Christmas.
Hal looked equally surprised, but then smiled.
The same to you.
Gray was still filled with Christmas feeling when he set off for Dover, literally, as the pockets of his greatcoat were jammed with sweetmeats and small gifts, and he carried under his arm a wrapped parcel containing the infamous carpet slippers, these lavishly embellished with lily pads and green frogs done in crewel work. He had hugged Dotty when she gave them to him, managing to whisper in her ear that her job was done. She had kissed him with such vigour that he could still feel it on his cheek and rubbed absently at the spot. He must write to William at once, though in fact there was no particular hurry, as a letter could not be carried any faster than he would go himself. He'd meant what he'd told Hal. As soon as a ship could set sail in the spring, he'd be on it. He only hoped he'd be in time. And not only for Henry. The roads were quite as bad as he'd expected, and the Calais ferry was worse, but he was oblivious to the cold and discomfort of the journey. With his anxiety for Hal somewhat allayed, he was free to think about what Nessie had told him. A bit of information he'd thought of mentioning to Hal, but hadn't, not wanting to burden his brother's mind, in case it might hamper his recovery. "Your Frenchman didn't come here," Nessie had told him, licking sugar off her fingers. "But he went to Jackson's regular when he was in town. He's gone off now, though, back to France, they say."
"Jackson's," he'd said slowly, wondering.
He didn't patronise boarding houses himself, bar Nessie's establishment, but he certainly knew about Jackson's, and had been there once or twice with friends. A flash house, offering music on the ground floor, gaming on the first floor, and more private diversions higher up. Very popular with mid-echelon army officers, but not, he was certain, a place catering to Percy Beauchamp's particular tastes.
"I see," he'd said, calmly drinking his tea, feeling his heart beat in his ears. "And have you ever come across an officer named Randall Isaacs?"
That was the part of his letter he hadn't told Hal. Dennis Randall Isaacs was an army officer known to frequent Beauchamp's company, both in France and in London, his informant had said. And the name had gone straight through Gray's heart like an icicle. It might be no more than a coincidence that a man known to associate with Percy Beauchamp had taken William on an intelligencing expedition to Quebec. But damned if he thought it was. Nessie had lifted her head abruptly at the name, Randall Isaacs, like a dog hearing the rustle of something in the brush.
"Aye, I have," she said slowly.
There was a blob of fine sugar on her lower lip. He wished to wipe it off for her, and in other circumstances would have.
"Or heard of him? He's a Jew, they say."
"A Jew?" That startled him. "Surely not.
A Jew would never be allowed to take a commission in the army or navy, no more than a Catholic." Nessie arched a dark brow at him.
"Perhaps he doesn't want anyone to know," she said,
and licking her lips like a cat, tidied away the blob of sugar. "But if not, he ought to stay away from Kittlehouses, that's all I can say." She laughed heartily, then sobered, hunching her bed sack over her shoulders, and staring at him, dark-eyed in the firelight.
"He's got summat to do with your wee lad, the Frenchie, too," she said, "for it was a girl from Jackson's told me about the Jewish cove, and what a shock it was to her when he took his breeches off. She said she wouldn't have, only his friend, the Frenchie, was there too, wanting to watch, and when he, the Frenchie, I mean, saw she was put off, he offered her double, so she did it. She said, when you came right down to it." And here she grinned lewdly at him, the tip of her tongue resting against the front teeth she still had. "It was nicer than some."
"Nicer than some,"
he murmured distractedly to himself, only half noticing the wary glance cast toward him by the only other ferry passenger hardy enough to stay above decks.
"Bloody hell."
The snow was falling thickly over the channel, and now swept nearly horizontal as the howling wind changed direction, and the ship gave a sickening lurch. The other man shook himself and went below, leaving Grey to eat branded peaches with his fingers from a jar in his pocket, and stare bleakly at the oncoming coast of France, visible only in glimpses through low-lying clouds. December 24th, 1776, Quebec City. "Dear Papa, I write you from a convent. Not, I hasten to explain, one of the Covent Garden variety, but a real Roman convent run by Ursuline nuns. Captain Randall Isaacs and I arrived at the Citadel in late October, intending to call upon Sir Guy and discover his opinion of the local sympathies regarding the American insurrection, only to be told that Sir Guy had marched to Fort Saint-Jean to deal personally with an outbreak of said insurrection, this being a sea battle, or so I suppose I must call it, which took place upon Lake Champlain, this a narrow body connecting with Lake George, which perhaps you will know from your own time here. I was much in favour of going to join Sir Guy, but Captain Randall Isaacs was reluctant in consideration of the distance involved and the time of year. In fact, his judgment was proved sound, as the next day brought freezing rain, this giving way shortly to a howling blizzard so fierce as to darken the sky so that you could not tell day from night, and which buried the world in snow and ice within hours. Seeing this spectacle of nature, I will admit that my disappointment at missing an opportunity to join Sir Guy was substantially allayed. As it was, I should have been too late in any case, as the engagement had already taken place upon the 1st of October.
We did not learn the particulars until mid-November, when some Hessian officers from Baron von Riedesel's regiment arrived at the Citadel with news of it.
Most likely you will have heard more official and direct descriptions of the engagement by the time you receive this letter, but there may be some details of interest omitted from the official versions. And to be frank, the composition of such an account is the only employment available to me at present, as I have declined a kind invitation from the Mother Superior to attend the mass they hold at midnight tonight, in observance of Christmas. The bells of the city's churches ring every quarter hour, marking time through the day and night. The convent's chapel lies directly beyond the wall of the guest house, in which I am lodged upon the highest floor, and the bell is perhaps 20 feet from my head when I lie in bed. I can thus inform you faithfully that it is now 9:15 p.m. To particulars, then. Sir Guy was alarmed by the attempted invasion of Quebec last year, even though it ended in abject failure, and had thus determined to increase his hold upon the Upper Hudson, this being the only possible avenue to which further trouble could come, the difficulties of land travel being so exigent as to prevent any but the most determined. I have a small jar of spirits of wine with which to present you, this containing a deer fly measuring nearly 2 inches in length, as well as a quantity of very large ticks, these removed from my person with the assistance of honey, which smothers them if applied liberally, causing them to lose their grip. While the invasion of last winter did not succeed, Colonel Arnold's men determined to deny Sir Guy access to the lakes, and thus sank or burned all the ships at Fort Saint-Jean as they withdrew, as well as burning the sawmill and the fort itself. Sir Guy had therefore requisitioned collapsible ships to be sent to him from England.
I wish I had seen these.
And 10 of them arriving, went down to St. John to oversee their assembly upon the upper Richelieu River. Meanwhile, Colonel Arnold, who seems an amazing industrious fellow, if half what I hear of him is true, had been madly building his own fleet of ramshackle galleys and hogbean sloops. Not content with his prodigies of prefabrication, Sir Guy also had the Indefatigable, a frigate of some 180 tons. Some argument between my informants as to the number of guns she carries, after a second bottle of the convent's claret. The nuns make it themselves, and from the shade of the priest's nose, no little of it gets consumed here too. Consensus was reached with, "A bloody lot, mate," always allowing for errors of translation being the final number. Taken apart, hauled to the river, and there reassembled. Colonel Arnold apparently decided that to wait any longer was to lose what advantage of initiative he might possess, and sallied out from his hiding place at Valcour Island on the 30th of September. By report, he had 15 craft to Sir Guy's 25, these former all hastily built, unseaworthy, and manned by landsmen who did not know a binnacle from a bunion. The American Navy in all its glory. Still, I must not laugh too much. The more I hear of Colonel Arnold, and I hear a great deal about him here in Quebec, the more I think he must be a gentleman of gall and kidney, as Grandpapa Sir George is wont to say. I should like to meet him one day. There is singing outside. The inhabitants are coming to the cathedral nearby. I don't know the music, and it's too far to make out the words, but I can see the glow of torches from my eyrie. The bells say it is 10 o'clock. The Mother Superior says that she knows you, by the way. Sir Immaculata is her name. I should scarcely have been startled by this. Told her that you know the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Pope, by which she professed to be much impressed, and begs you will convey her most humble obeisance to His Holiness when next you see him. She kindly asked me to dinner, and told me stories of the taking of the citadel in 59, and how you quartered a number of Highlanders upon the convent. How shocked the sisters all were by their bare legs, and sought a requisition of canvas that they might make the men trousers. My uniform has suffered noticeably through the last few weeks of travel, but I am still decently covered below the waist, I am relieved to say. So was Mother Superior, no doubt. I return to my account of the battle. Sir Guy's fleet sailed south, intending to reach and recapture Crown Point, then Ticonderoga. As they passed Valcour Island, though, two of Arnold's ships sprang out upon them, firing in challenge. These then attempted to withdraw, but one, Royal Savage, they said, could not make way against the headwinds and ran aground. Several British gunboats swarmed her and captured a few men, but were forced to withdraw under heavy fire from the Americans, though not omitting to set fire to the Royal Savage as they did so. A great deal of manoeuvring then ensued in the strait, and the battle began in earnest about midday, the Carlton and Inflexible bearing most of the brunt of the action, along with the gunboats. Arnold's Revenge and Philadelphia were badly hit by broadsides, and the Philadelphia sank near evening. The Carlton continued firing until a fortunate shot from the Americans severed the line to her anchor, causing her to drift. She was heavily attacked, and a number of her men killed or injured. The butcher's bill, including her captain, a Lieutenant James Dacres. I have an uneasy feeling that I have met him, perhaps at a dance last season, and the senior officers. One of her midshipmen took command and carried her to safety. They said it was Edward Pellew, and I know I have met him once or twice at Boodle's with Uncle Harry. To resume. Another lucky shot struck the magazine of a gunboat and blew it up, but meanwhile the Inflexible was finally brought into play and battered the American boats with her heavy guns. The smaller of Sir Guy's craft landed Indians, meanwhile, upon the shores of Valcour Island and the shore of the lake, thus cutting off this avenue of escape, and the remnants of Arnold's fleet were thus obliged to retreat down the lake.
They succeeded in slipping past Sir Guy, the night being foggy, and took refuge at Skylar Island, some miles south. Sir Guy's fleet pursued them, though, and was able to draw within sight of them the next day. Arnold's boats being much hampered by leakage, damage, and the weather, which had turned to heavy rain and high wind. The Washington was caught, attacked, and forced to strike her colours, her crew of more than 100 men being captured. The rest of Arnold's fleet, though, managed to get through to Button Mould Bay, where, I understand, the waters are too shallow to allow Sir Guy's ships to follow. There, Arnold beached, stripped, and set afire most of his craft, their flag still flying, as a mark of defiance, the Germans said. They were amused by this, but admired it. Colonel Arnold, or must we now call him Admiral Arnold, personally set fire to the Congress, this being his flagship, and set off overland, narrowly escaping the Indians who had been set to prevent him. His troops did reach Crown Point, but did not linger there, pausing only to destroy the fort before withdrawing to Ticonderoga. Sir Guy did not march his prisoners back to Quebec, but returned them to Ticonderoga under a flag of truce. A very pretty gesture, much admired by my informants. 10:30. Did you see the Aurora Borealis when you were here, or was it too early in the year? It is a most remarkable sight. Snow has fallen all day, but ceased near sunset, and the sky has cleared. From my window, I see a northern exposure, and there is presently an amazing shimmer that fills the whole sky, waves of pale blue and some green, though I have seen it to be red sometimes, that swirl like drops of ink spilt in water and stirred. I cannot hear it at present because of the singing. Someone is playing a fiddle in the distance. It is a very sweet and piercing tune. But when I have seen the phenomenon outside the city in the woods, there is often a most peculiar sound, or sounds, that accompany it. Sometimes a sort of faint whistling, as of wind around a building, though there is no movement of the air. Sometimes a strange high hissing noise, interrupted now and then by a fusillade of clicks and cracklings, as though a horde of crickets were advancing upon the listener through dry leaves. Though, by the time the aurora begins to be seen, the cold has long since killed all insects, and good riddance. We applied an ointment used by the local Indians, which was of some help against stinging flies and mosquitoes, but does nothing to discourage the inquisitiveness of earwigs, roaches, and spiders. We had a guide for our journey between St. John and Quebec, a man of mixed blood. He had a most remarkable head of hair, thick and curly as sheep's wool, and the colour of cinnamon bark, who told us that some of the native people think that the sky is a dome, separating earth from heaven, but that there are holes in the dome, and that the lights of the aurora are the torches of heaven sent out to guide the spirits of the dead through the holes. But I see I have yet to finish my account, though it is only to add that following the battle, Sir Guy withdrew to winter quarters in St. John, and likely will not return to Quebec until the spring. So, now I come to the true point of my letter. I rose yesterday to discover Captain Randall Isaacs had decamped during the night, leaving me with a brief note saying that he had urgent business, had enjoyed my company and valuable assistance, and that I was to remain here until either his return or the arrival of new orders. The snow is deep, more may come at any moment, and business must be urgent indeed, which could compel a man to venture any distance. I am, of course, somewhat disturbed at Captain Randall Isaac's abrupt departure, curious as to what might have happened to cause it, and somewhat anxious as to his welfare. This does not seem a situation in which I would be justified in ignoring my orders, however, and so I wait. 11:30. I stop writing for some little time to stand and watch the sky. The lights of the aurora come and go, but I think they have gone altogether now. The sky is black, the stars bright but tiny by contrast with the vanished brilliance of the lights. There is a vast emptiness in the sky that one seldom senses in a city. despite the clangour of the bells, the bonfires in the square, and the singing of the people. There is a procession of some kind going on. I can feel the great silence beyond it. The nuns are going into their chapel. I leaned out of my window just now to watch them hurrying along, two by two, like a marching column, their dark gowns and cloaks making them look like small pieces of the night, drifting among the stars of their torches. I have been writing a long time. You must forgive the fancies of an exhausted brain. This is the first Christmas I have spent with no sight of home or family. The first of many, no doubt. I think of you often, Papa, and hope you are well and looking forward to roast goose tomorrow with Grandmama and Grandpapa Sir George. Give my love to them, please, and to Uncle Hal and his family, and to my Dotty, especially. A very Merry Christmas from your son, William. Postscriptum, 2 a.m. I went down after all and stood at the back of the chapel. It was somewhat popish, and there was a great deal of incense, but I said a prayer for Mother Geneva and for Mama Isabel. When I emerged from the chapel, I saw that the lights have come back. Now they are blue. Chapter 25. The Bosom of the Deep. May 15th, 1777. My dears, I hate boots. I despise them with the utmost fibre of my being. And yet I find myself once more launched upon the dreadful bosom of the sea, aboard a craft known as the Tranquil Teal, from which of certainty you may deduce the grim whimsy of her captain. This gentleman is a smuggler of mixed race, evil countenance, and low humour, who tells me, straight-faced, that his name is Trustworthy Roberts. Jamie paused to dip his quill, glanced at the receding shore of North Carolina, and, observing it to rise and fall in an unsettling manner, fixed his eyes at once upon the page he had tacked to his lap desk to prevent its being borne away by the stiff breeze that filled the sails above his head. "We are in good health," he wrote slowly, putting aside the notion of seasickness, upon which he did not propose to dwell. Ought he to tell them about Fergus, he wondered. "Feeling all right?" He looked up to see Claire bending to peer at him with that look of intent but cautious curiosity she reserved for people who might at any moment vomit, spurt blood, or die. He had already done the first two, as a result of her having accidentally put one of her needles into a small blood vessel in his scalp, but hoped she didn't distinguish any further signs of his impending demise. "Well enough." He didn't even want to think about his stomach, for fear of inciting it, and changed the subject in order to avoid further discussion. "Shall I tell Brianna and Roger Mack about Fergus?" "How much ink have you got?" she asked with a sidelong smile. "Yes, of course you should. They'll be very interested. And it will distract you," she added, squinting slightly at him. "You're still rather green."
"Aye, thanks."
She laughed with the cheerful callousness of the good sailor, kissed the top of his head, avoiding the four needles protruding from his forehead, and went to stand by the rail, watching the wavering land recede from view. He averted his gaze from this distressing prospect and returned to his letter. "Fergus and his family are also well, but I must tell you of a puzzling occurrence. A man who calls himself Percival Beauchamp." It took him most of a page to describe Beauchamp and his baffling interest. He glanced up at Claire, wondering whether he should also include the possibility of Beauchamp's relationship to her family, but decided against it. His daughter certainly knew her mother's maiden name and would notice it at once. He had no further useful information to provide in that respect, and his hand was beginning to ache. Claire was still at the rail, one hand on it for balance, her face dreaming. She had tied back the mass of her hair with ribbon, but the wind was whipping strands out of it, and with hair and skirts and shawl streaming back, the cloth of her gown moulded to what was still a very fine bosom, he thought she looked like a ship's figurehead, graceful and fierce, a protective spirit against the dangers of the deep. He found that thought obscurely comforting, and returned to his composition in better heart, despite the disturbing content he had now to confide.
Fergus elected not to speak with Monsieur Beauchamp, which I thought wise, and so we presumed this to be the end of the matter. While we were in Wilmington, though, I went down to the docks one evening to meet Mr. Delancey Hall, our liaison with Captain Roberts. Owing to the presence of an English man-o'-war in the harbour, the arrangement was that we should repair discreetly aboard Mr. Hall's fishing ketch, which would transport us out with the harbour, whence we would rendezvous with the Teal, Captain Roberts disliking close proximity to the British Navy. This is a fairly universal response on the part of private and merchant captains, owing both to the prevalence of contraband aboard most ships, and to the Navy's rapacious attitude toward the ship's crews, who are routinely abducted, pressed, they call it, and to all intents and purposes, enslaved for life, save they are willing to risk hanging for desertion. I had brought with me some minor items of luggage, intending, under the pretext of taking these aboard, to inspect both the ketch and Mr. Hall more closely before entrusting our lives to either. The ketch was not at anchor, though, and Mr. Hall did not appear for some time, so that I began to worry lest I had mistaken his instructions, or that he had run afoul either of His Majesty's Navy, or some fellow rapscallion or privateer. I waited until it had grown dark, and was on the point of returning to our inn, when I saw a small boat come into the harbour with a blue lantern at its tail. This was Mr. Hall's signal, and the boat was his ketch, which I assisted him to tie up to the quay. He told me that he had some news, and we repaired to a local tavern, where he said that he had been in New Bern the day before, and there found the town in an uproar, owing to an infamous assault upon the printer, Mr. Fraser. By report, he, Fergus, was making his rounds of delivery, and had just got down from the mule cart, when someone sprang upon him from behind, thrusting a sack over his head, and someone else attempted at the same time to seize his hands, presumably with the intent of binding them. Fergus naturally resisted these attempts with some vigour, and according to Mr. Hall's story, succeeded in wounding one assailant with his hook, there being a certain amount of blood to substantiate this assumption. The wounded man fell back with a scream and uttered loud oaths. I should have been interested to know the content of said oaths, in order to know whether the speaker might be French or English, but this information was not included. Whereupon Clarence, who you will remember, I think, became excited, and apparently bit the second assailant, this man and Fergus having fallen against the mule in their struggle. The second man was discouraged by this vigorous intervention, but the first returned to the fray at this point, and Fergus, still blinded by the sack but bellowing for help, grappled with him, striking at him again with his hook. Some reports, says Mr. Hall, claim that the villain wrenched the hook from Fergus's wrist, while others claim that Fergus succeeded in striking him again, but that the hook became entangled in the villain's clothing and was pulled off in the struggle. In any event, people in Thompson's Ordinary heard the skirmish and rushed out, whereupon the villains fled, leaving Fergus somewhat bruised and most indignant at the loss of his hook, but otherwise unharmed, for which God and St. Dismas, he being Fergus's particular patron, be thanked. I questioned Mr. Hall as closely as I could, but there was little more to be learned. He said that public opinion was divided, with many saying that this was an attempted deportation, and that the Sons of Liberty were to blame for the attack, while some members of the Sons of Liberty indignantly denied this accusation, claiming that it was the work of loyalists, incensed over Fergus's printing of a particularly inflammatory speech by Patrick Henry, and the abduction was a prelude to Tar and Feathers. Apparently Fergus has been so successful in avoiding the appearance of taking sides in the conflict that both sides are equally likely to have taken offence,
and decided to eliminate his influence. This is, of course, possible, but with the presence and behaviour of Monsieur Beauchamp in mind, I think a third explanation is more likely. Fergus declined to speak with him, but it would not have required a great deal of further inquiry for him to learn that despite his name and Scottish wife, Fergus is a Frenchman. Surely most of the inhabitants of New Bern know this, and someone could easily have told him. I confess myself to be at a loss as to why Beauchamp should wish to abduct Fergus rather than simply come and confront him in person to inquire whether he might be the person for whom the gentleman claimed to be searching. I must assume that he does not mean Fergus' immediate harm, for if he did, it would be a fairly simple matter to have arranged to have him killed. There are a great many men of no attachment and mean character drifting through the colony these days. The occurrence is worrying, but there is little I can do about it in my present abject position. I have sent Fergus a letter, ostensibly regarding the specifications of a printing job, which lets him know that I have placed a sum with a goldsmith in Wilmington, which he may draw upon in case of need. I had discussed with him the dangers of his present position, not knowing at the time how dangerous they might actually be, and he agreed that there might be some advantage to his family's safety in his moving to a city where public opinion is more strongly aligned with his own inclinations. This latest incident may compel his decision, the more particularly as proximity to ourselves is no longer a consideration. He had to stop again, as pain was radiating through his hand and up his wrist. He stretched the fingers, stifling a groan. A hot wire seemed to stab from his forefinger up his forearm in brief electric jolts. He was more than worried for Fergus and his family. If Beauchamp had tried once, he would try again. But why? Perhaps the fact of Fergus's being French was not sufficient evidence that he was the Claudel Fraser that Beauchamp sought, and he proposed to satisfy himself upon this point in privacy, by whatever means came to hand. Possible, but that argued a coldness of purpose that disturbed Jamie more than he had wished to say in his letter. And in fairness, he must admit that the notion of the attack having been executed by persons of inflamed political sensibility was a distinct possibility, and perhaps of a higher probability than the sinister designs of Monsieur Beauchamp, which were both romantical and theoretical to a high degree. "But I haven't lived this long without knowing the smell of a rat when I see one," he muttered, still rubbing his hand. "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," said his personal figurehead, appearing suddenly beside him with an expression of marked concern. "Your hand?"
"Aye?"
He looked down at it, cross with discomfort.
"What's amiss? All my fingers are still attached to it."
"That's the most that could be said for it. It looks like the Gordian knot." She knelt down beside him and took the hand into hers, massaging it in a forceful way that was doubtless helpful, but so immediately painful that it made his eyes water. He closed them, breathing slowly through clenched teeth. She was scolding him for writing too much at once. What was the hurry, after all? It will be days before we reach Connecticut, and then months on the way to Scotland. You could write one sentence per day and quote the whole book of Psalms along the way.
"I wanted to," he said.
She said something derogatory under her breath, in which the words Scot and pig-headed featured, but he chose to take no notice. He had wanted to. It clarified his thoughts to put them down in black and white, and it was to some degree a relief to express them on paper, rather than to have the worry clogged up in his head like mud in mangrove roots. And beyond that, not that he required an excuse, he thought, narrowing his eyes at the top of his wife's bent head. Seeing the shore of North Carolina drop away had made him lonely for his daughter and Roger Mack, and he'd wanted the sense of connection that writing to them gave him.
"Do you think you will see them?"
Fergus had asked him that, soon before they took leave of each other.
"Perhaps you will go to France."
So far as Fergus and Marsali and the folk on the ridge were concerned, Brianna and Roger Mack had gone to France to escape the oncoming war.
No,
he'd said, hoping the bleakness of his heart didn't show in his voice.
I doubt we shall ever see them again.
Fergus's strong right hand had tightened on his forearm, then relaxed.
Life is long,
he said quietly.
Aye,
he'd answered, but thought,
no one's life is that long.
His hand was growing easier now. While she still massaged it, the motion no longer hurt so much. I miss them too, she said quietly, and kissed his knuckles. Give me the letter. I'll finish it. Your father's hand won't stand any more today. There is one notable thing about this ship, beyond the captain's name. I was down in the hold earlier in the day and saw a good number of boxes all stenciled with the name Arnold and New Haven, Connecticut. I said to the hand, whose name is a very pedestrian John Smith, though no doubt to make up for this distressing lack of distinction, he has 3 gold earrings in one ear and 2 in the other. He told me that each one represents his survival from the sinking of a ship. I am hoping that your father doesn't know this. That Mr. Arnold must be a very successful merchant. Mr. Smith laughed and said that, in fact, Mr. Benedict Arnold is a colonel in the Continental Army, and a very gallant officer he is, too. The boxes are bound for delivery to his sister, Miss Hannah Arnold, who minds both his 3 small sons and his importing and dry goods store in Connecticut, while he is about the business of the war. I must say that a goose walked across my grave when I heard that. I've met men whose history I knew before, and at least one of those I knew to carry a doom with him. You don't get used to the feeling, though. I looked at those boxes and wondered, ought I to write to Miss Hannah, get off the ship in New Haven and go to see her? And tell her what, exactly? All our experience to date suggests that there is absolutely nothing I could do to alter what's going to happen. And looking at the situation objectively, I don't see any way. And yet, I've come close to so many people whose actions have a noticeable effect, whether or not they end up making history as such. How can it not be so, your father says. Everyone's actions have some effect upon the future, and plainly he's right. And yet to brush so close to a name like Benedict Arnold gives one a right turn, as Captain Roberts is fond of saying. No doubt a situation that gave one a left turn would be very shocking indeed. Well, returning tangentially to the original subject of this letter, the mysterious Monsieur Beauchamp. If your father's, Frank's, I mean, if you still have the boxes of papers and books from his home office, and a free moment, you might go through them and see if you find an old manila folder in there, with a coat of arms drawn on it in coloured pencil. I think that it's azure and gold, and I recall that it has martlets on it. With luck, it still contains the Beauchamp family genealogy that my Uncle Lamb wrote up for me, lo, these many years ago. You might just have a look and see whether the incumbent of the name in 1777 was perhaps a Percival, for the sake of curiosity. The wind's come up a bit, and the water's getting rough. Your father has gone rather pale and clammy, like fish bait. I'll close and take him down below for a nice quiet vomit, and a nap, I think. All my love, Mama. Chapter 26. Stag at Bay. Roger blew thoughtfully across the mouth of an empty stout bottle, making a low, throaty moan. Close. A little deeper, though, and of course it lacked that hungry sound, that growling note. But the pitch. He got up and rummaged in the refrigerator, finding what he was looking for behind a heel of cheese and 6 margarine tubs full of God knew what. He'd lay odds it wasn't margarine. There was no more than an inch or so of champagne left in the bottle. a remnant of their celebratory dinner the week before, in honour of Bree's new job. Someone had thriftily covered the neck of the bottle with tinfoil, but the wine had, of course, gone flat. He went to pour it out in the sink, but a lifetime of Scottish thrift was not so easily dismissed. With no more than an instant's hesitation, he drank the rest of the champagne, lowering the empty bottle to see Annie MacDonald holding Amanda by the hand and staring at him.
"Well, at least you're no putting it on your cornflakes yet," she said, edging past him. "Here, pet, up you go."
She hoisted Mandy into her booster seat and went out, shaking her head over her employer's low moral character.
"Gimme, Daddy."
Mandy reached for the bottle, attracted by the shiny label. With a statutory parental pause as he mentally ran through potential scenarios of destruction, he instead gave her his glass of milk and hooted across the champagne bottle's fluted lip, producing a deep, melodious tone.
Yes, that was it.
Something close to the F below middle C.
"Do again, Daddy."
Mandy was charmed. Feeling mildly self-conscious, he hooted again, making her fall about in a cascade of giggles. He picked up the stout bottle and blew across that one, then alternated, working up a two-note variation to the rhythm of Mary Had a Little Lamb. Attracted by the hooting and Mandy's ecstatic shrieks, Brianna appeared in the doorway, a bright blue plastic hard hat in her hand.
"Planning to start your own jug band?" she asked.
"Already got one," he replied,
and having decided that the worst thing Mandy could do with a champagne bottle was to drop it onto the rug, handed it to her and stepped out into the hall with Brianna, where he pulled her close and kissed her deeply, the baize door swinging shut with a cushioned whoosh.
"Champagne for breakfast?"
She broke the kiss long enough to ask, then returned for more, tasting him.
"Needed the bottle,"
he mumbled, tasting back. She'd had porridge with butter and honey for breakfast, and her mouth was sweet, turning the champagne bitter on the edges of his tongue. The hall was chilly, but she was warm as toast under her fleece jumper. His fingers lingered just under the edge of it, on the bare, soft skin at the small of her back.
"You'll have a good day, aye,"
he whispered. He fought the urge to slide his fingers down the back of her jeans. Not respectful to be fingering the arse of a brand-new inspector of the North of Scotland Hydroelectric Board.
"You're bringing the hat home after?"
"Sure.
Why?"
"Thought you might wear it in bed."
He took it from her hand and set it gently on her head. It made her eyes go navy blue.
"Wear it, and I'll tell you what I wanted with a champagne bottle."
"Oh, now there's an offer I can't ref—"
The navy blue eyes slid suddenly sideways, and Roger glanced in that direction to see Annie at the end of the hall, broom and dustpan in hand, and an expression of deep interest on her narrow face.
"Yeah, have a good day,"
Roger said, letting go hastily.
"You too."
Face twitching, Brianna took him firmly by the shoulders and kissed him, before striding down the hall and past a round-eyed Annie, whom she airily wished good day in the Gaelic. A sudden crash came from the kitchen. He turned automatically toward the baize door, though less than half his attention was on the incipient disaster. The greater part was focused on the sudden realization that his wife appeared to have departed for work, wearing no knickers. Mandy had, God knew how, managed to throw the champagne bottle through the window and was standing on the table reaching for the jagged edge of the pane when Roger rushed in.
"Mandy!"
He grabbed her, swung her off the table, and in the same moment smacked her bottom once. She emitted an ear-piercing howl, and he carried her out under his arm, passing Annie Mac, who stood in the doorway with mouth and eyes all round as O's.
"See to the glass, aye,"
he said. He felt guilty as hell. What had he been thinking, handing her the bottle, let alone leaving her by herself with it? He also felt a certain irritation with Annie Mac, After all, she was employed to watch the children. But fairness made him admit that he ought to have made sure she'd come back to watch Mandy before he left. The irritation extended to Bree as well, prancing off to her new job, expecting him to mind the household. He recognised that the irritation was only his attempt to escape the guilt, though, and did his best to put it aside while soothing Mandy, having a wee chat about not standing on tables, not throwing things in the house, not touching sharp things, calling for a grown-up if she needed help. Fat chance, he thought, with a wry inward smile. Mandy was the most independent 3-year-old he'd ever seen. Which was saying something, considering that he'd also seen Jem at that age. One thing about Amanda, she didn't hold a grudge. 5 minutes after being smacked and scolded, she was giggling and begging him to play dollies with her. "Daddy's got to work this morning," he said, but bent so she could scramble onto his shoulders. "Come on, we'll find Annie Mac. You and the dollies can maybe help her get the pantry sorted." Leaving Mandy and Annie Mac happily working in the pantry, supervised by an assortment of scabby-looking dolls and grubby stuffed animals, he went back to his office and got out the notebook into which he was transcribing the songs he'd so painstakingly committed to memory. He had an appointment later in the week to talk with Siegfried MacLeod, the choirmaster at St. Stephen's, and had it in mind to present him with a copy of some of the rarer songs by way of creating goodwill. He thought he might need it. Dr. Weatherspoon had been reassuring, saying that MacLeod would be delighted to have help, especially with the children's choir, but Roger had spent enough time in academic circles, Masonic lodges, and 18th-century taverns to know how local politics worked. MacLeod might well resent having an outsider, so to speak, foisted on him without warning. And there was the delicate issue of a choirmaster who couldn't sing. He touched his throat with its pebbled scar. He'd seen 2 specialists, one in Boston, another in London. Both of them had said the same thing. There was a possibility that surgery might improve his voice by removing some of the scarring in his larynx. There was an equal possibility that the surgery might further damage or completely destroy his voice. "Surgery on the vocal cords is a delicate business," one of the doctors had said to him, shaking his head. "Normally we don't risk it unless there's a dire necessity, such as a cancerous growth, a congenital malformation that's preventing any useful speech, or a strong professional reason. A well-known singer with nodules, for instance. In that case, the desire to restore the voice might be sufficient motive to risk surgery. Though, in such cases, there usually isn't a major risk of rendering the person permanently mute. In your case..." He pressed 2 fingers against his throat and hummed, feeling the reassuring vibration. No, he remembered all too well what it felt like to be unable to speak. He'd been convinced at the time that he'd never speak, let alone sing again. The memory of that despair made him sweat. Never speak to his children? To Bree? No, he wasn't risking that. Dr. Weatherspoon's eyes had lingered on his throat with interest, but he hadn't said anything. MacLeod might be less tactful. "Whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth." Weatherspoon, to his credit, hadn't said that in the course of their discussion. It had, however, been the quotation chosen for that week's Bible group. It had been printed on their flyer, which was sitting on the rector's desk. And in Roger's hypersensitive frame of mind at the time, everything looked like a message.
"Well, if that's what you've got in mind, I appreciate the compliment," he said out loud. "Be all right with me if I wasn't your favourite just this week, though."
It was said half-jokingly, but there was no denying the anger behind it. Resentment at having to prove himself to himself one more time. He'd had to do it physically last time. Now to do it again, spiritually, in this slippery, less straightforward world? He'd been willing, hadn't he?
"You asked. Since when do you not take yes for an answer? Am I missing something here?"
Bree had thought so. The height of their quarrel came back to him now, making him flush with shame.
You had. I thought you had, she corrected,
a vocation. Maybe that's not what Protestants call it, but that's what it is, isn't it? You told me that God spoke to you. Her eyes were intent on his, unswerving, and so penetrating that he wanted to look away, but didn't.
Do you think God changes his mind? She asked more quietly, and laid her hand on his arm, squeezing.
Or do you think you were mistaken?
No,
he'd said in instant reflex.
No. When something like that happens, well, when it did happen, I wasn't in any doubt.
Are you now?
You sound like your mother, making a diagnosis.
He'd meant it as a joke, but it wasn't. Bree resembled her father physically to such a degree that he seldom saw Claire in her, but the calm ruthlessness in her questions was Claire Beecham to the life. So was the slight arch of one brow, waiting for an answer. He took a deep breath.
I don't know.
Yes, you do. Anger bubbled up, sudden and bright, and he jerked his arm away from her grasp.
Where in hell did you get off telling me what I know?
She widened her stare. I'm married to you.
You think that entitles you to try to read my mind?
I think that entitles me to worry about you.
Well, don't.
They'd made it up, of course. Kissed, well, a bit more than that, and forgiven each other. Forgiving, of course, didn't mean forgetting. Yes, you do. Did he know?
Yes, he said defiantly to the broch, visible from his window. Yes, I damned well do.
What to do about it? That was the difficulty. Was he perhaps meant to be a minister, but not a Presbyterian?
Become a non-denominational? An evangelical? A Catholic?
The thought was so disturbing he was obliged to get up and walk to and fro for a bit.